Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, December 8th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Gambia's president-elect promises to implement his country's TRRC recommendations.
There will be justice and reconciliation, reparations. It will all happen. But we have to be patient. We have to take our time. I am the architect of this project. I think nobody wouldn't have interest in this project more than myself.
A Kenya police officer killed six people, including his wife, yesterday, Tuesday. The convicted son of former Liberian President Charles Taylor, Chucky Taylor, says prosecutors misrepresented his case. Burkina Faso's 1.3 million displaced people increasingly fall victim to terrorists. And a prison fire in Burundi's capital kills 38 prisoners yesterday, Tuesday.
The fire broke around 4 a.m., but the fire section would just happen to come after 6 in the morning, which means that for more than 2 hours, prisoners were exposed to fire.
And the environmental impact of a hydropower dam project in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Gambia's president-elect Adama Barrow says he will continue to implement his reform agenda, which includes implementation of the Truth, Reconciliation and Reparations Commission TRRC recommendations, as well as a new constitution. As Sajo Brito reports from Banjul, Mr. Barrow made the remarks on Tuesday at his first news conference after being declared winner of Saturday's election.
The Independent Electoral Commission said President Barrow won re-election by securing 53% of the votes. The president-elect told reporters he is committed more than ever to continue his reform agenda, including the implementation of the TRRC report, which investigated alleged human rights violations perpetrated during former President Yahya Jammeh's administration. President Barrow has always described himself as the architect of the TRRC, but critics have alleged political interference with the work of the commission following delay in the submission of their report. Political pundits and civil society have also accused President Barrow of putting politics ahead of justice following his decision to join forces with the party of former President Yahya Jammeh during the campaign. When asked how far and fast his administration is willing to act on the TRRC report following his re-election, President Barrow had this to say.
The document got to the National Assembly, and they disagree on the document. We try to negotiate through mediators. We couldn't agree. It is suspended, but I assure you, I want that project to be part of my legacy. I assure you, you will have a new constitution before the end of my term.
President Barrow also spoke on the issue of presidential term limits, which was supposed to be addressed in the new draft constitution bill, but which was voted down in 2020 by lawmakers. Many Gambians condemned the rejection of the draft constitution as they hoped for better laws to replace the 1997 constitution. President Barrow's critics accused him of masterminding the rejection of the draft constitution bill. But Barrow told reporters at his first news conference that the country will have a new constitution before the end of his term.
There will be justice and reconciliation, reparations. It will all happen. But we have to be patient. We have to take our time. And I said it, I am the architect of this project. I think nobody wouldn't have interest in this project more than myself.
Meanwhile, the leader of the opposition Gambia Democratic Congress Party, Mama Kande, has reiterated his decision to reject the December 4th election results. Kande told journalists Tuesday he will not accept the results because they are not fair. He also said he will not be calling President Barrow to congratulate him. Sajo Brito, VOA Daybreak Africa, Banjul.
The convicted son of former Liberian President Charles Taylor, Chucky Taylor Jr., says prosecutors misrepresented his case. Charles Chucky Taylor Jr., also known as Roy Belfast, was sentenced to 97 years in prison in 2009 by a federal court in Florida for torture and conspiracy to commit torture. Prosecutors say the young Taylor abused his role as commander of the notorious anti-terrorist unit during his father's administration to commit torture. Mr. Taylor called VOA yesterday from the federal prison to explain why he feels prosecutors misrepresented his case.
Out of the 32 witnesses, 23 were alleged victims, 9 were federal officials. Okay, so essentially, before anything could have happened, the government was supposed to have substantiated that I conspired with 2 persons or more. It's a 2 or more requirement in order to assert conspiracy. That's under 18 U.S.C. 371, which is a reflection of how the torture statute 234A(c), conspiracy to commit torture, is applied. In numerous filings, the government and the courts have said that the substantive counts of the conspiracy were intertwined. Well, it placed a great burden to prove count one. As I said, in the case of Jackson versus Virginia, the Supreme Court specifically, in Jackson versus Virginia 443 U.S. 317, speaks about the fact that juries can even get it wrong as well as judges. There is no evidence on the record that the government proved this conspiracy. As a result, we're talking about a record that is devoid and a detention that is illegal. So this misrepresentation is in reference to how the government asserted this case and continues to assert the fact that they are upholding a valid conspiracy, which is far from the truth. Based upon the release of information by the Department of Justice, this ultimately requires an internal investigation. There's a violation of 4001A. That duty is placed upon the executive, not your judicial branch.
You mentioned a legal fund that you are trying to establish. First of all, what is it, and is it permitted under prison rule to do that?
I'm not prepared to create the context for further acts of nuanced intimidation to take place. So everything I do is according to program statement. But yes, I have launched a legal fundraising website under fundraiser, fundrazer.com/FreeCharlesEmmanuel. To raise funds in order to lobby for an investigation and file a civil rights lawsuit to have the Department of Justice to investigate these errors under injunctive relief.
Earlier, I referred to you as Mr. Taylor, but you wanted me to call you by a particular name. What is that name?
Romaye. I no longer abide by the Taylor name for cultural reasons. I'm presently using my mother's maiden name, but it is not a name that I choose to adopt as well. Romaye, to me, represents the evolution of who I am. It's a very personal name. It's actually an acronym, as well as Somel. As far as I'm concerned, I'm under no obligation to perpetuate Mr. Taylor's name. My siblings are the ones who are obligated, duty-bound, to do so.
How do you spell it again, please?
G-O-M-A-A-E.
So you say you're under no obligation to the Taylor name, and I asked you earlier, what is the relationship between you and your father?
Well, again, it's been frayed prior to Mr. Taylor having left Monrovia. I left before him, a month before, and arrived in Trinidad and Tobago. Let me be clear, both my parents are immigrants. I'm a first-generation American. I think ultimately, you know, after reflecting and reading and becoming in tune with Africa's history, I can't really get past the failures and the betrayal that I felt in having believed in someone and had placed my trust. And, you know, there were signs of that took place, and obviously, you know, leaders in those positions sometimes don't like dissent. They don't like to be questioned. They don't like counter-narratives or curiosity to be explored. And that often happened when we were together.
And what's the length of your sentence? I mean, are you likely to be released soon?
No. The pursuit for legal donations are an attempt to lobby for an investigation to overturn an illegal sentence. This 97-year sentence was illegally asserted. And I say it clearly, illegally asserted. When people go to the fundraiser.com/FreeCharlesEmmanuel, they will see specific facts substantiating these claims. These are not hollowed allegations. I've been very patient in attempting to correct this thing, allowing the courts to address the merits of this issue, and it has not happened yet. It's clear to me that the hurdle is too great and that a law firm is needed. No man is an island. I believe in self-reliance, as I've said before, and I've attempted to fight this thing on my own, all by myself. I'm unable to do so.
That was Charles Chucky Taylor Jr. speaking with us from a federal prison in the U.S. state of Florida. Burundian authorities say 38 prisoners died after fire broke out in the main prison in the capital Bujumbura yesterday, Tuesday. A Burundian official who refused to be interviewed said in a text message that authorities reacted swiftly to the fires and rescued hundreds of prisoners. He said the fire was caused by a short circuit after prisoners made homemade installations from electrical cables in their prison cells. However, Agathon Rwasa, the leader of Burundi, Burundi's main opposition National Congress for Liberty Party, the CNL, says prisoners were exposed to the fires for more than 2 hours before firefighters would arrive.
It is a pity that this fire happened early this morning, and it is also unfortunate to see that the fire broke around 4 a.m., but the fire section would just happen to come after 6 in the morning, which means that for more than 2 hours, prisoners were exposed to fire without any kind of help. Officials mentioned that 38 people were killed in that fire. Nevertheless, there is no precision about those who could have succumbed to their burns in hospitals or any other health facilities in Gitega. And, you know, even the press didn't have the chance to cover up what was happening. And we can just only rely on what the deputy president has just said till some investigation can reveal something else.
What are the authorities saying in terms of what caused the fire?
Authorities are saying that it was caused by some fishy installation which has been said to be made by the prisoners themselves in terms of getting some light in the cells or getting somehow how they could change their phones. But something strange happened 2 days ago. The tribunal in Gitega have been vandalized and more than 1,000 files disappeared. And even the register of the prisoners or those who go through the tribunal have been falsified, and nobody can know exactly what should be the cause of this. So all what we can say, till deep investigation are made, we cannot just rely on what is said that it was caused by some fishy wiring of the prisoners themselves. Because one could wonder how come that the prisoners get those wires through which channel, for instance. So let's see what will be the outcome of the investigation. Then we will have to rely on what can be really reliable.
Does the prison have a system to extinguish fires?
This prison, which was burned this morning, has been built in colonial area time. So I think there is no system of extinguishing fire in case this could happen. Besides, the prison of Gitega, as well as other prisoners in Burundi, are overcrowded. It is said to be built for around 300 people, but when the fire broke, it had more than 1,300 prisoners.
Agathon Rwasa is the leader of Burundi's main opposition National Congress for Liberty, CNL party. He was speaking with us from the capital, Bujumbura. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Wednesday, December 8th. A police officer in Nairobi, Kenya, killed six people, among them his wife, before killing himself yesterday, Tuesday. Kenya's Ministry of Interior has linked the incident to a love triangle and mental health illness in the police service. As Marine Ojiambo reports from Milwaukee, USA, the police officer, Ben Saint Mbatu, shot his wife immediately after returning home from work before going on a shooting spree.
The Kenya police has launched investigations into the shooting incident by a police officer in Nairobi that claimed the lives of six people Tuesday morning. The police officer, identified as Constable Benson Imbato, committed suicide after the morning shooting spree by shooting himself on the neck. The deceased include his wife, neighbors, and motorbike operators known in Kenya's Boda Boda riders who had rushed to his house to check what had happened when they heard gunshots. Kenya's Interior Cabinet Secretary Fred Matiang'i said that the matter is under investigation and that the incident could be love gone sour.
One of our officers in Dagoretti has taken his life and five other lives in the process. We are investigating the matter. Our internal affairs unit officers are there. DCI Kinodi's team has been there. We want to get to the bottom of that incident. And we will go the direction investigations will point us. All I want to plead with my fellow Kenyans is let us exercise a sense of responsibility.
The Independent Policing Oversight Authority has dispatched its rapid response team to obtain information that may be relevant in unveiling the circumstances surrounding the shooting incidents. Francis Wahome, the police commander where the officer was attached to, said that the officer was at work and excused himself from duty. Wahome said preliminary investigations had shown that the officer had quarreled with the wife before the man picked up the gun and shot his wife, identified as Carol.
Alienda kwa nyumba yake na akampiga risasi mke wake.
He went to his house and shot his wife. He then left with his firearm. And anybody found on the road was his target. When we heard the report, we mobilized our officers so that we could prevent more death. But as we kept pursuing him, we kept getting reports from the public that they have seen him pass by and there are people he had killed. Eventually, when he realized he had been cornered, he decided to shoot himself.
Akajipiga risasi.
Locals in the area held demonstrations blocking roads for several hours before they were dispersed. One of the victim's wife said that the husband met his death while at work, where he works as a boda boda operator at night. He is called Amos Njoroge. He works as a boda boda operator at night. He comes back home at 6 in the morning. He did not come back today, so I called him several times and he did not pick up. I then decided to go where he works. I found his motorbike at the scene and he was no more. I'm yet to go to the mortuary to confirm it's his body.
He was my breadwinner.
The Kenyan government is now saying it will commit more resources to mental health and counseling in the police and prisons department to help officers deal with stress and other personal challenges. Member of Parliament for Westlands, the area where the incident took place, Tim Wanyonyi, says the Kenya police must look into matters affecting their officers.
We must also address the issue of mental health within the police service and other regions, because we have seen these incidents happening almost everywhere in the country. And this today incident has shown that actually there is a very serious problem in the service.
According to the Independent Policing Oversight Authority, IPOA, Section 25 of IPOA Act dictates that deaths and injuries occasioned by actions of the police to be investigated by the authority, regardless of whether the officer involved is dead or alive. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Milwaukee, USA.
A hydropower dam project in one of Africa's oldest national parks could be a breach of Congolese conservation law, in addition to threatening tropical forests in the region, according to a report released today, Wednesday, from Global Witness. The author of the report, Colin Robertson, spoke to Ricky Stryak about the issue.
The project is controversial because it appears from the documents we've seen that the dam would be inside the national park, which is a breach of Congolese conservation law and would obviously have a very serious impact on the park itself. It would flood a large section of the Lufira Valley, which is an area that's very important for biodiversity. We also found that the initial environmental impact assessment of the dam appears to be quite lacking in terms of its it hasn't really analysed in detail the impact of the dam on the park itself.
What kind of actions are civil society organizations in the country taking to address these issues, and what are their actions being met with in regards to the government?
There are a number of Congolese civil society organizations who've raised concerns about this dam inside Upemba National Park, and also about other projects that are taking place inside other national parks in Congo, activities such as mining that are having a detrimental impact on some of the country's national parks. I think the Congolese conservation body, which is called the ICCN, has a new director who's been in place since August. It really remains to be seen if the ICCN will change direction and protect some of these national parks more vigorously in future.
Beyond this one project, there are many, whether it's extraction of resources or projects that infrastructure projects that are lacking transparency, that are constantly happening in DRC that have a negative impact when it comes down to it on the people who live in the country. What kind of systematic changes need to happen in order to improve the situation for Congolese residents?
Well, obviously, DRC is one of the countries in the world with the most natural resources in terms of mining, petrol, hydropower, but also some of the world's most important protected areas, forests, and ecosystems. So I think there's always pressure on some of the national parks. What we've seen in the past is that they haven't always been vigorously protected by Congo's authorities, and there's often a lack of transparency about many projects to do with mining, for example. I think given that we're at a time when the international community has pledged a lot of money to protect Congo's forests, for example, at the recent COP summit, I think the international community also needs to watch much more closely about what's happening on the ground in Congo, so that those forests and people who depend on them are well protected in the future. I think it's also important to bear in mind that some of the companies building these projects are very large multinationals, and they're often bankrolled by banks or asset managers who could be in Europe or in the US. And I think it's important that those investors as well keep a very close eye on where their money is going, and if it's funding projects that are having a damaging impact on sensitive ecosystems.
That was Colin Robertson, author of a report on the Sambwe Dam project in the DRC. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from London. In the shadows of the coronavirus pandemic, violence against women has been on the rise around the world, including in South Africa, where half of the country's women report at least one incident of violence in their lifetime. Now, a local tech company has developed an alarm system to help stop the abuse. For VOA, Linda Gift has reports from Johannesburg.
A click of a button could save a woman's life. That's what South African firm Afritech Technologies hopes to achieve with its Alert app. Gender-based violence has become so rampant during coronavirus lockdowns, President Cyril Ramaphosa has called it the country's second pandemic. Afritech presents its app as one solution, allowing users to discreetly alert friends, family, and authorities that they're in danger. AB Musa is the CEO of Afritech Technologies.
We're not saying that our tech or our solution is the silver bullet, but it certainly is one of the pieces of this big puzzle that can make a difference. And I think COVID became a catalyst for a lot of people to adopt, a lot more people to adopt technology. And hence why we felt creating a technological solution.
The South African Police Service says more than 10,000 people were raped between April and June this year. Another 15,000 cases of domestic violence were reported in the same period. Organizations providing support to survivors say those figures don't paint a full picture, as many more cases go unreported. The lack of data about the crisis is another solution Afritech plans to provide with the information it collects from users.
We're also putting AI systems behind our app to be able to then hopefully predict trends of what's going to happen. So empower police stations, empower private security, empower NGOs to then be able to have a proactive rather than a reactive response to this challenge.
People without smartphones can still use the alert system. The company has designed a panic button that looks like a USB stick, as well as a wristwatch that provides the same response. Social workers say these interventions will make a big difference, but more still is needed. Linda Giftash for VOA News, Johannesburg.
And that's it for this Wednesday, December 8th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington saying, have a great day.